This week, we click the donate button on healthcare.gov because bandwidth is expensive. Welcome to the Midwest Peace Process.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Ladies and gentlemen.
I have the pleasure to present to you now. Ladies and gentlemen.
Ladies and gentlemen.
I have the pleasure to present to you.
The Midwest Peace Process.
The world is very different now.
The Midwest Peace.
To remind process. America of the fierce urgency of now. 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 Now.
Welcome to episode 65. Today is November 8th, 2013. I'm Jerry.
I'm Eric. I'll be your Jeremy this evening.
And this is Rob.
And we have a special guest with us this evening. Our listener Chris joins us.
Hello, everyone. Listener. Wait, he's here.
All right. We are back at our usual haunt here at Granite City Food and Brewery. We are well lubricated for this episode.
Yeah, we felt the coffee at the last spot made us a little jittery.
That's right. So we're relaxing here with some beers.
We've changed our substance abuse of choice.
This episode, we're going to spend some time talking about healthcare, obviously, and the failure of the healthcare.gov website.
Not a failure.
Oh, come on, Rob.
It's a failure.
Yeah.
Has anybody gone on there?
No.
I just wanted to go down there and see if I can get a spinny wheel.
Yeah. Just wanted to see the spinning wheel.
I don't want to take up any bandwidth from the people right. that really need it, you know.
Maybe that's the problem. Maybe it's Tea Party Republicans all around. It's denial of service attack.
That could be.
But not through any kind of hacker script, but just endless clicking.
Right.
F5.
For you computer geeks out there. Never, those F5 jokes never get old.
I think that's what it is. Okay, so the website's bad.
Yes. So, of course, the questions now are, you know, why is it bad? Who do we blame? How do we fix it? How much is it going to cost? How long is it going to take? All those questions.
Has anybody heard why it's difficult? I haven't heard why it's difficult. It's like seems like the web front end. Like, that's got to be a solved problem, right? Is it connecting with the insurance companies? Is it the back end of that? Like, what's the big deal?
I think, from what I've heard of the hearings that have been held over the last couple of weeks in front of Congress...
Pretty funny.
Way too many contractors, right? They farmed this out to way too many subcontractors, and your lead integrator is a government agency.
Right.
So, I mean, that is a recipe for disaster, in my opinion.
Yes.
But I think that does detract from a bit more fundamental problem of, you know, whether or not that website succeeds, well, in the short term, they'll get it fixed.
Right.
You know, they'll be able to get people through the system. You know, did you hear the number on how many people actually got signed up the first day? It was like 10. You know, some I'm not kidding. It was some ridiculously small number.
Right.
And not a whole lot more than that the second day. So the success of Obamacare, I mean, it is an insurance policy. And the success of Obamacare relies on a lot of people being insured. So what are the odds? I mean, have you heard, you know, the calculations they did to be able to say that this is, you know, neutral on the deficit because they're going to be avoiding so many more Medicare payments downstream stuff like that. Well, that's all predicated on the assumption of how many people are going to get signed up.
Right.
You know, especially young, healthy people that don't need health insurance today.
Right.
So how many young people are going to be signing up for several hundred dollar a month health care insurance that they don't feel they really need right now?
Yeah. Right. You know, there's a carrot and a stick, right? Right now it's just the carrot.
Well,
but the stick will come later, and that's when you're going to get all the, you know, the invincibles, the people who, you know, think they don't need health care.
Right. So one thing I would say is just because the success of the first couple of days wasn't great. I mean, I know everyone talked about the first day, only 10 people signed up, but that's not really... A lot of people probably went on anyway just to see. I know when I signed up for my insurance at work even, it takes me, you know, weeks, several weeks to figure out all the options, which one do I really want.
Right.
So if no one signed up the first day, I wouldn't consider that to necessarily be bad. A lot of people want to see what's even available, right? This is the first time this has even come out. So
true, but so the way they were promoting this, they had all those volunteers out there, you know, trying to get people out.
I don't think they expected 10.
Right.
Yeah, they expected more than 10. Yeah, exactly. I don't know if that's...
Well, like I said, you know, that's why, you know, I said there's a question in my mind. You know, that's not a good, you know, canary in the coal mine, so to speak, for, you know, where this is going long term.
Right, and that's the thing is like if you're not an Obamacare supporter, you can't really attack just the technology of the website. You got all these Republican House Representative guys that are like trying to talk web servers and, you know, stumbling over themselves. It's not really the point, really, if you really think about it from a big picture. Like even if you're a supporter, you got to see how the thing's supposed to work. And it's got to work if it's easy for a lot of people to buy into the system, right? And if you put roadblocks on them and then you're going to whack them with a penalty, you know, that's what they should be focused on as a criticism.
So, Rob, got to ask you then. So, Obamacare, bad law or worst law ever?
it's an awesome law.
I will say, I mean, I'm not necessarily a fan of it, but here's what I don't get, and I got to play the anti-Jeremy for a second. I don't get the Republican fixation on it. You know, that this is the thing that's going to bring down our country. You know what I mean? Because in my mind, it's like, okay, you got Medicare, you got Medicaid, you got Social Security.
Yeah.
And those seem, those are great.
Right.
But this kind of next step is that's the downfall of our country.
It's because somebody had a focus group in the 08 election cycle that said, you know, people are against health care.
Yeah.
And nobody has bothered to have that focus group again and update the statistics. So they're still running on, you know, 5-year-old data.
But
so you said something about the criticisms against it. For me, you know, from my perspective, it's three layers deep, right? Because, I mean, you start off with the fact that, all right, government shouldn't provide health care. That's a fact, all right? Then the next layer is they implemented this, like, the law itself is implemented wrong. Like, you know, they made a bunch of poor choices in writing the law. And then the third layer is they screwed it up.
Yeah.
You know? So it's like, all right, where do you want me to start on criticizing this? Because I can go, you know, three layers deep.
All right, let me hit your first layer. Because it kind of conflicts with what you said, Eric. You said the government shouldn't be providing health care. Well, and I think the Republicans and conservatives in general, or at least conservatives that are trying to get elected and not be nut job Tea Party guys, I think they have a cognitive dissonance about Medicare and Social Security, right?
Yeah.
You know, because you're Jerry, you're pure of heart, like an angel, you know. So you really believe that, and I will tip my cap to you that you really truly believe government should have no role in providing health care. You're willing to let those chips fall where they may.
Right. But
that's not true with what Republicans that are trying to get elected are thinking.
Right.
They're going to cling to their AARP and their Social Security and their Medicare.
Well, because what is kind of ironic to me is that a lot of the constituents in these Tea Party districts really rely a lot on either Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, right?
Right, right.
And so it's kind of funny. Some of those people actually stand the most to gain by some of these laws.
Right.
And then the Tea Party is saying, well, this is an awful idea.
Right.
You know?
Right. And I think that's why why do they hate it so much? I think it violates their core of their principles, and that they don't think that government should be providing health care at all. But then they can't really run against the programs that are already in place.
Right, because they're popular.
It's just going to, like, sneak in there as one more little tumor on the system. It's not a tumor.
Right.
And you'll never be able to get rid of it.
Because you don't have health insurance, right?
Right, right. That's right. And I think it's, and overall, like, yes, about what I thought about the law in general, it's like government is already providing health care for all these people. That's why when I get a flu shot or whatever it is, it costs me $420 because I'm paying for all of the costs that nobody else is paying.
Right.
And so we have a situation where we are paying for everybody, and this is at least trying to. It's like we're owning up to what's going on.
And if you're
to be honest about it.
And if you're spreading that cost over those 10 people who have signed up, they're going to be pissed.
Exactly.
Why was that the first one in here? Well, what do you say, Chris? Give us some new perspective.
yeah, I got nothing.
Here's
a single box one.
Yep.
Yeah, great. things like that.
Duke?
Yeah, yeah.
You
I'm doing.
Sorry, that was beer ordering.
Yeah. Hey, it happens, right? It's an occupational hazard here.
I think one of the other Republicans' kind of complaints against it is that they don't feel that, you know, they feel like it should be a statewide thing and not a federal thing. You know, so they don't necessarily complain about Massachusetts, or maybe some of them do, but they care about the federal government doing this on a grand scale. You know, each state should be able to choose the way that it wants to do its health care.
Like Tennessee kind of, with their lottery?
That was kind of like,
I
get all my news from the Daily Show, so take it for what it's worth. But no kidding. You had to call in, and if you were one of the lucky ones, and you got health insurance, basically.
Right. Yeah, I heard that. So.
But I think that was one of the Republican objections to it. At least at one point was that. That was Mitt Romney's thing. Yeah, I like Romney care.
Well, post hoc rationalization built something pretty similar, so we can't be really against that. So
right, I don't know.
I think a lot of the Republicans and maybe some of the libertarian view is the federal government should not be involved in these grand scale plans.
Yes.
Right. And so this is a grand scale plan that a state has no choice in anymore. Really, they have a little bit of choice.
Right, it's definitely pushing down to the state. Right.
They don't really have the choice that they would have, or that they have now. So, or they had before this.
Well, they have as much choice as they currently have on drug laws, right?
It's the federal government that says, "Look, we got this screwed up. Let's see if we can fix it." And but it does. It does push. It pushes responsibilities onto people. And it pushes responsibilities into the states. That's definitely for sure.
I'm not saying I disagree or agree with it. Right. I'm just saying I think that's a view that a lot of Republicans / libertarians have about it.
Right. And what do we do now? Like, what's the system before Obamacare? As far as I understand it, that there's a monstrous slush fund that we all pay into as just a fraction of our income taxes, and it all goes to the federal government as this big old blob. Here now you got this big old treasure chest of money, and then when states and hospitals say, hey, we need to recover the cost of these people that aren't paying, they get a federal grant, which is called a grant, which is kind of a funny term for it, but it's really the money flowing into the Central Planning Institute, you know,
right,
and then flowing out via these grants to hospitals. Is that a good way to do it? Like, and this is why I think the Heritage Foundation, you know, supposedly really hatched this plan. It's like we have companies and actuaries and smart little mathy people that all they do is assess risk and try to maximize this profit. Why are we doing it in this big sort of pool and out situation? Let's just make them all get insured because insurance works. Like, I think, so when you ask about like worse law or terribly worse law, I understand the concept. I feel like we've told ourselves that yes, we will pay for healthcare for everybody. It's like we've made that decision, and now that we've done that, well, how do we make that happen? And I think this is a good step towards it. But I agree kind of with what you're saying. It's like unless you're willing to, the most purest form is you say, look, you're buying a service from me. If I want to buy a massage or a coffee or a TV, and I can't pay for it, well, you don't get the service. You know, but it's not a service like that. I can go up there with no money and say, hey, I got the Spanish flu. Did people even get Spanish flu anymore?
No.
Oh, no. Let's say I got it, right?
Ahead,
right. Say I got it, I'm a scientific anomaly.
Well, keep going.
You know, I have no money. I'm going to get care, and somebody's got to pay for that. And what's the best way to pay for that? We've made that decision.
But now help me out, though. Low-income people can get subsidies toward their health insurance. They get through healthcare.gov. But you still, I mean, if Joe average person goes in there and signs up, they still have, I mean, it's several hundred dollars or more a month that they're paying in healthcare insurance. I mean, they're not getting it for free, is my understanding.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's not... I mean, the government is helping to subsidize that. I mean,
right.
Yes, it is. It is a Robin Hood kind of thing, right? Because
right.
We're paying taxes in, but that's why I was talking about, you know, the young healthy people. You know, I'm out of school, got $100,000 in college debt, and that, and you want me to go online and pay a few hundred dollars for health insurance? Right. I feel fine, right?
Right.
Yeah, and
yeah, that's a pretty hard sell. I
right.
mean,
it kind of what I heard, like the people that's really hitting is like if you got your gold plated plan, you're going to be fine, or at least for now until they zotch all our gold plated plans. But it doesn't really affect your gold plated plan. And if you had no health insurance before and you can get a subsidy, you win. You know, you're doing well. There's a spot in the middle there, like all these sort of programs, where somebody falls through the cracks. And like a good old NPR story, those liberals. It was a farmer, and a farmer probably had like gobs of assets over time. You know, he's probably worth, you know,
$1 million.
Right.
Yeah.
Probably worth $1 million, and you know, his income was certainly, you know, a sizable income, and he had this big family, but he didn't have an employer to pay for a gold-plated plan.
Right.
So now he needed to go, and so he intentionally had a what I call a crappy plan, high deductible, yeah, low policy kind of thing. Well, then that got canceled. And now he needed a better plan. And, you know.
Well, that's. I mean, we haven't talked about this yet either. Is the infamous "if you like your current plan, you can keep it" statement, right?
Right?
That. Come on, Rob, you can't. I know Obama's your guy. You can't defend that one.
You had to squint, and it said, "if you like your quality plan."
Yeah. Missed a little quality in there.
That's
right?
True.
Right. He had his fingers crossed behind his back while he said it.
But you got to admit, that caught an awful lot of people off guard. You think, I've got health insurance, I'm fine.
Right.
And then you find out, oh, because of Obamacare, sorry, you got to pay a couple $100 more a month
for
coverage that you didn't think you needed.
I'm totally sympathetic to that. But to play the liberal role, I think it only really affected a certain section of people who preferred a high deductible.
But if it's the middle third of the bell curve,
I don't think it is the middle third.
That's a ton of people. It's not over yet. I mean, right? We're just now hearing. You know, this is the.
It's a pretty large number.
It's the beginning of the flood, I think. Of the number of companies that are saying, yeah, we either can't compete, or the current plan that we're offering doesn't meet the requirements
right.
of Obamacare, so we have to stop offering it.
And you can argue about whether or not that's a good thing. You know, I mean, are they, you know, am I selling you a Yugo telling you it's a Cadillac?
Right,
you know,
right.
Okay. So maybe that's a point or not, but the way, obviously, that the program was sold was, hey, if you got health insurance, we're not going to interfere with that. Well,
right.
that's obviously not true.
Right, and that message, what that message was to people with nice plans.
Yeah.
And I had a nice plan, so I was like, hey, you know.
Right.
But when I heard that, I completely, I can freely admit I completely neglected to think about what that meant for plans that weren't nice plans, you know? Well, because that was, it's kind of an internally inconsistent argument that he was even making on the stump, you know? He's like, we got to get rid of these junky plans that pre-existing conditions, you know, kick you
right.
out, you know? So he was saying we got to get rid of these, you know, junky plans. But he was like, you can keep your plan. Well, you know, by doing that math, you figure out, well, you can
right.
keep your plan if it's not one of these junky ones.
And
you know?
The thing is, you know, somebody did that math already.
Right.
Somebody in his administration already knew this was going to happen, and they've just not said anything about it because they knew it was going to be, you know, political suicide.
Well, I think when he said you're keeping your plan, he's talking to the majority of people with employer-based health care.
So the thing about it is, it's a trickle right now of stories that you're hearing about all these companies canceling the plan, but it's going to be a flood. That's my prediction.
I'd have to go look it up, but at some place I saw numbers. So the insurance companies knew how many people were going to be affected.
Right.
And how many letters they were going to have to send out.
Right. And
it was not an insignificant number by any means.
It's the middle third of the bell curve, Rob.
You can look pensive all you want, Rob.
I don't... My doomsday prediction of doomsday predictions, I haven't quite heard a good refutation of this is employers are trying to get rid of, and I think they don't want to, I don't know, maybe they do. I don't think they want to kind of get out of this healthcare business thing anyway, I think. And you might have these government exchanges that might start undercutting the cost of that thing. And so what I worry about is going to happen is, yeah, we have our employer-based healthcare. They meet the minimum standards, so there's really no change, just like good old Obama said. What's going to prevent companies that provide employer-based healthcare to just say, look, we're not doing it anymore. You're all fine. Just go to your state exchange. You're going to be fine. We'll pay you. If your state exchange says it's going to cost you $200 a month, I'll just kick $200 in your salary, and we're done. We're, you know.
Right.
And then I think, is that even a doomsday scenario? Because I kind of want the employer. I think the employer tied with the healthcare thing is kind of why we ended up in this scroogey spot in the first place. It definitely goes to what you say, Jerry. I mean, it's not a, it's not a, not a. Your employer is paying you for a service that you provide to
right.
the company. You know.
It's well, like, and we talked about this in the last episode. It's like, how much does healthcare cost?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know.
Right.
You don't know. None of us know because
right.
none of us pay for it. And that's the problem. I mean, that you want to do the root cause analysis on this.
But when you've, you know, broken your arm and run into the emergency room, you're not going to run to three different emergency rooms
right, market price
to figure out who can set your arm at the most, you know, cost-effective price. Right.
right. It makes sense to have some kind of system in place that is going to average out all of those costs for
well,
you as an individual.
I definitely think... Gosh,
and
that's what
insurance is supposed to do, right?
I wasn't here for the last one, but I guess I was agreeing with some of your statements. There was that Time Magazine article, right, about the cost of healthcare and that kind of thing. There's definitely a complete lack of visibility into what healthcare actually costs. And,
right.
And when Medicare pays a bill versus an health insurance versus some, you know, Joe average guy having to pay on their own, it's vastly different prices. And in my mind, that's got to change. You know, it's kind of like... It's kind of like if a gas station said, well, go ahead, pump your gas, and I'll tell you what you're going to have to pay for,
right,
you know?
Right.
So there's a significant problem there, and there's no motivation right now for the hospitals to fix that.
Well, so I was thinking about this since the last episode, and, I mean, insurance is, it's a casino, right?
Right.
And so you don't know the odds, just like you don't know the odds when you walk into a casino. But you have to believe they're stacked against you, right? Because insurance companies are not...
They're for-profit.
Right, they're for-profit,
yes.
So they're there to make a buck. And so I understand what you're saying. It would be like if I walk into the casino and I have to put, you know, $2 in the slot machine before I can pull the handle, but the guy next to me is feeding a dollar in at a time.
Right.
And, yeah, I would agree that that probably needs to be addressed. If that's going on, I don't know that it is, but I think it's safe to assume that it is.
Yeah. Well, like, there's definitely, assuming you believe this Time Magazine article, there's definitely no consistency from hospital to hospital. There's no consistency from person to person. The only thing they all agreed on was that Medicare actually does the best job of getting a good deal for its patients out of these hospitals.
Right. I've heard that.
Single payer, baby.
Woo!
Government option.
Yeah. All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to cover some some host feedback. And,
yeah, that's a first.
And a couple other topics. So stay with us. We are back.
Woo!
And believe it or not, we have some host feedback from Jeremy. Even though he's not here, he mentioned a few things that he wanted to hear us talk about. We've already covered Obamacare, but there was one story in the news this past week about a guy who was pulled over. It was a routine traffic stop. I think he rolled through a stop sign or something in a shopping center parking lot. Cops stopped him, and this escalated into the guy was in a hospital for like 12 hours being forced to have enemas and a colonoscopy by the police. It's like, really? How do you get from rolling through a stop sign to force what amounts to sodomy in a hospital?
So you're saying that's a bad thing?
Yeah.
It was a master cleanse. He had a headlight out. So that...
Some people pay for that, you know. I mean,
he got it for free. You're right. It's probably, and Obamacare probably paid
for it.
It,
yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, this just plays into, you know, my normal pet peeve about cops, because I'm pretty sure this was, you know, cops on a power trip abusing their authority.
Probably so. I don't think there's a lot to argue about there. I'm certainly not going to defend the right of cops to...
I will not defend
forcibly
searches for traffic stops.
Okay, good. We can all agree on that one.
That was easy.
That was easy. So Jeremy also pointed out, well, I'll just read it. He said, I saw something interesting on the Weather Channel. With all the climate change stuff, it was a National Geographic picture of what Earth would look like if all the ice melted. And I got a link in the show notes to this. The title is Rising Seas If All the Ice Melted. It's on National Geographic's website. Interesting, but maybe not as different as I thought. The kicker was, at the end, the narrator says, scientists believe that if it warmed enough to melt all of the ice, it would take 5,000 years for all of it to melt.
Okay.
Okay, whatever.
Well,
there's a lot of ice out there.
Yeah.
Miles of it in Antarctica.
Right.
Right, and it's not about the ice. It's the supposedly these scientists, these liberal scientists, with their PhDs and their papers with technical terms on them, say that, you know, if the Earth warms enough for this to actually happen, the least of your problem is that you've lost part of Florida.
Right.
You have bigger issues at hand.
So
it's the warming, not the ice. I lost my southern coast.
So there are countries on, you know, little islands in the South Pacific who are worried about climate change because essentially their island will disappear.
Yes.
If ocean levels rise too much.
A few feet, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, you hear those things and it's always in the context of, you know, 50 years from now, if we continue on the pace we're at, these places will disappear. And so I think all Jeremy is saying is that there's some conflict there in a 50-year time scale versus a 5,000-year time scale.
So representing the scientist side of things in the show tonight, I think one of the
Professor
bigger...
Professor Proton here.
Well, I wish. one of the bigger problems I think we have is the disconnect between what scientists are saying, the studies they actually do, versus how the media presents those, you know? And the media wants headlines, right? And, you know, scientists tend to be a lot more cautious in the verbiage they use between themselves and the papers and everything. So I very much am sympathetic with people saying, look, you know, I saw this article about these scientists on CNN, and they said, you know, the sun's going to boil tomorrow, and didn't happen. See, stupid scientists. Well, actually, if you go back and read, you know, the original paper, you know, the original paper versus the way CNN presented are two different things.
Right.
So, and I will say, too, it's very, very difficult for somebody like any of us to go back and read those source papers and make any sense out of them.
Sure.
They're hard. I mean, these guys have PhDs for a reason.
Right.
So you read the distilled down stuff, and it confuses things more than it helps a lot of times.
Yeah, and I mean, we've talked about this on the show before, about how I believe that, you know, the climate change camp does a very poor job of communicating.
Yes, absolutely.
They don't get their, you know, they don't get their message out there in a clear and concise way.
Yeah, agreed.
What they need a Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Oh,
that's what they need.
He's still my pounding heart. Yes.
If the climate change camp had a Neil deGrasse Tyson, they'd be set.
Yeah, I agree 100% on that. No question about it. That's two easy ones.
Yeah.
That's a good way to put it.
We're solving all the world's problems.
No doubt. All right. So, you know, call your friends, Eric, in the climate change camp. Tell them to start recruiting.
I know the ones, wink, wink.
Yeah.
I know where the money comes from.
It's going to be funny you say that about the papers, because as a former math student, I would play this game with myself where I would read a paper and see how far I could get. And I was like, if I made it like third paragraph, I was like,
you're
going to
do
it. We're getting better, you know? Yeah. Like, they, you know, basically talked maybe what numbers were. And I was like, all right, I think I'm with
right.
it, you know? They would define some symbols. I've seen symbols. You know, in my third paragraph. And I'm done.
Yeah, and they're multiplying matrices, and yeah, I'm out.
Okay, quick joke, because I follow this feed on Twitter. It has, like, science jokes and that. And they said, how scientists really work. And it shows this guy holding this paper, says, you know, I'm a cell biologist and this is a biochemistry paper. I think I need some help. And how movie scientists work, you know, I'm a cell biologist, this is particle physics, I got this. You know?
Right.
I, I don't think the general, and I think scientists do a poor job because they're so specialized. Right, they have their blinders on. They just want to go do their research.
And they're really talking to each other.
They're really talking to each other that people don't have appreciation for just how specialized they really are and how, you know, they just think that, oh, well, some geologist over on Fox News said we don't have to worry about anything.
Right.
He's a geologist. You understand that's different than a climate scientist, you know. Indeed. Well, no, he studies the Earth.
He's a scientist.
It's got geo in it. Yeah. Put him in a white coat, all set.
All right, so a couple stories here that I want to make sure we talk about. Had a little back and forth on Twitter with a guy named Eric Liu, who's a opinion writer for CNN. He took issue with a Russell Brand video that's been kind of going around the internet the last week or two. And for anybody who doesn't know, Russell Brand's a comedian, right? But he's become very political in recent, I don't know, months, years. I'm not sure how long he's been involved. But most recently, he was named editor of, and now the name escapes me, it's a political website, blog thing. Anyway, they asked him to be the editor of it. And so this video that's going around...
I mean, I know who Russell Brand is, but so is he, like, Al Franken, like, serious about this stuff kind
yes.
of thing? Bill
yeah.
Maher-ish? Okay.
He's trying to... He's getting there.
Yeah. Okay. And so this video is some well-known, you know, talking head there in Great Britain interviewing him, basically taking him to task, like, you know, you're a comedian. Why are you doing that, you know? And I mean, the response that he gets is just fabulous. You know, he really shuts this guy down. Russell Brand shuts this guy down. And so that's why a lot of people are like, yeah, go, you know. So this video's gone viral. Anyway, one of the things that this talking head guy criticizes Russell Brand for is the fact that he doesn't vote. And, you know, trots out the old saw, well, if you don't vote, you can't complain, blah, 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 blah. Which, you know, I've talked about on the show in the past. And so I'm on board with Russell's argument up to the point where he says, you know, I want a revolution, but I want to replace the existing government with a different government that does things differently. I can't support that, but everything else he says, I'm on board with. So anyway, this Eric Liu guy on CNN basically is saying, well, what he got wrong was the voting part. You have to vote. Everybody's got to participate in the process or it doesn't work.
So this is like some op-ed you said on CNN.
Yeah.
Okay.
And, and so I replied to him and I was like, no, you really don't. I mean, voting is this, it's this false dichotomy between Democrats and Republicans. And the solutions that we need, they lie outside that false dichotomy. And... You know, he replied and said, well, basically, you know, mobilizing people to vote is the only thing that's ever changed anything. It's the only thing that ever will. And
well,
my
response... Well, I mean, obviously the American Revolution didn't start with them voting the king out.
Right.
Right, you know.
Exactly. But, my response to him was, okay, but who picks the candidates, right? Because otherwise, you know, it just gives you the illusion of choice. If the candidates are being selected by...
A star chamber kind of, yeah.
Right. The
yeah.
people with money, the Illuminati, whoever it is you believe picks
the candidates. Yeah,
the climate scientists. You know, everybody goes out, they vote, they do their civic duty. You know, they
you
go out and
sticker,
vote.
Jerry.
Right, you get a sticker, you wear it with pride, everybody thinks they've done their part and participated in the process. You're just another cog in the machine.
You think a vote is half... You're voting a little bit for that candidate and you're lending credence to a system you think should not get such credence.
I think it started out legitimate, and at some point the powers that be realized that they could morph the system in such a way that it still felt like people were having a choice, that they were in command. But the reality is you're just trading one moron for another every 4 years.
Or two in the case of representatives.
Well, yeah, two or six, depending on which house of the Congress.
Now, you do have primaries, though. So, I mean, they're giving you some options to get to that option,
I mean,
right?
Do you see the Tea Party as kind of I mean, there are a lot of Republicans don't really, they work kind of outside the system in some sense.
Right.
And so they had an impact. I mean, I think they've had we've seen a pretty sizable impact from over the past couple of years. I mean, to say that the voter has no sway or pull to people in that are outside the system, I don't know if that's entirely true.
There have been individual aberrations. I mean, Ross Perot, 92, Ron Paul in the last two election cycles. But
I think a bigger thing about maybe just that the voting is important, but I think it's also the stuff that we don't do, right? Like, we don't go to city council meetings. We don't go to the school board meetings. We don't go to all the things that matter and see what's really going on in our government. Because, I don't go to those things. My wife goes to them, and she sees all that stuff, but no one else sees it. And so I think
all politics is local.
If they were plugged into that, as well as then seeing that and taking actions based on that and then voting that way, it would hold those people more responsible for the things they do. So voting's like a piece of the puzzle, but maybe not the entire thing.
Now, see, I disagree with that because I believe if you get involved at a local level, you become jaded even more quickly than you would otherwise because you see the corruption and the cronyism and all the bullshit that goes on at the local level, and it's infinitely worse as you scale it up.
Like, but that's because none of people are involved to see that. If everyone saw the corruption and whatnot, I think there would be a change.
Maybe.
But because only a few people see it, it's like one voice in a big hall with a million people and no one can hear it.
Right. So, you go to a county council meeting and there's only 20 people in the room.
It's like Overland, right? Overland, they recalled their mayor, right? And so no one went to Overland City Council meetings. And my parents finally started going when Ann Persner was going to be recalled, right? They couldn't have enough room for these people that actually wanted to see what was going on and get her out of office, right? So, So if that happened to every city council meeting, there would be a lot more people watching, and I think things wouldn't be so underhanded and, you know, like city council now is like, we're going to go to closed session. Who knows what they do in closed session?
Right.
They go to closed session all the time because we're talking about, you know, personal matters, you know. But it doesn't, I think that's part of the piece is people are not as involved as they should be, and then when they use their vote with that, that would make, their vote would mean something a little better, and it would help people keep them more honest. But
right.
Maybe that's where it's broken. Maybe we're the problem. We don't participate.
Oh, there's no question we're the problem.
I like the sunshiny view.
Oh, that's
nice to have some optimism on the Midwest peace process.
We're the problem is optimism?
Yeah, we can fix it.
No, you can't.
Not the Illuminati with their triangles with an eye on top. I don't know what that means.
No. The problem is our democracy relies on an informed electorate, which we don't have. Not sure we can get it back.
The people have made this argument, I've heard too, but do you think the people in the 1700s were more informed than we are today? I mean, a lot of those people didn't read very well. They certainly didn't have a great education, a lot of them.
Jerry's going to disagree with you there. I agree with you.
And yet we say that, we've lost that. Did we ever really have an informed populace?
Or maybe the people that were voting were all the educated landowners.
That's part of it.
Well,
so how is that a democracy?
Well, that's true. And I won't say that was necessarily wrong. I think you have to have some skin in the game. I think that people who...
what it says in the beautiful documents we...
Well, it does. That's what it says now. Let's not forget, it's in, you know, grandparents' lifetime that women couldn't vote.
Right.
I'm not opposed to women voting. Let's make that
that's
clear.
Good to get on the record. Yeah.
Let's get that out there.
Quote for the day. I'm not opposed to women voting.
I'm not trying to repeal women's suffrage.
Today.
But what I am saying is that when you are part of this collective, whatever it is, whether it be a town, whether it be a county, a state, an entire country, if you have nothing to lose, your vote should not matter as much as the people who do have something to lose. You see what I'm saying?
I mean, I guess it depends on what you define as have something to lose.
Well, voting yourself largesse from the public treasury... And I'm quoting, I don't know if it was Jefferson or who it was, the people who are responsible for producing that money that goes into the public treasury should be the ones who get to decide how it's spent. And that's not the system we have today. We have a very large number of people who are allowed to vote without producing anything that becomes part of this pie that we're dividing among everyone. You see what I'm saying?
This is a new thing.
What's a new thing?
We're breaking new ground here.
Episode 72 or whatever we're on. 65.
Thank you, Chris.
I think it was on the page.
I haven't heard this before.
Well, you kind of alluded to this before, I think. I mean, I don't think.
It's not something that I would say I'm, you know, extremely passionate about. It's just, you know.
Well, this kind of goes back to your DRO.
Yeah.
Stuff, where you talked about, you know, you're paying for services you don't want.
Right.
And maybe this is part of that. I don't know, essentially. But I guess as part of the DRO, and that's almost a tangent here, the DRO part is you're always going to be paying for something that you don't want. You know, like, you say, well, I don't want that service. I can fire my DRO and get something else. I could go to someone else. The thing is, anything you go out and want, any service you buy, you're not going to get every little feature you want. You're not going to be able to get the phone.
There's not an infinite number of those.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And if there were a store that they would all get condensed down because there's only one person buying that one specialized phone. So no matter how you slice it, you're going to pay for something you don't want. You know, now then you're making a deal just like we do today. Well, I do want these things, and things are more important to me.
Right.
So you're never just going to be able to get everything you want. That's kind of
a myth
that you could ever have that.
The fundamental difference there is you always have the option of not spending any money at all. You don't have to buy the phone.
Right, but if you want a phone, right, you gotta spend money on.
Well, if you want a phone, unless you know how to engineer a phone on your own that does everything you want and nothing that you don't, you gotta pay somebody else to do that for you.
But when I brought that up,
things you don't want.
I think last time I was here and I brought up some of those lines. You compared that to sort of living off the grid, right? That they're, you know, not part of society in some sense of the word. So, in other words, to be part of society, you gotta make some sacrifices for things you don't want.
I think so.
Well,
live like Walden.
Define part of society.
Well, that's kind of what you were saying, I thought. And so you want to live as part of this grouping, this collection of people. Yeah, good phrase. So you're willing to put up with a non-ideal situation from your personal belief system.
If I always have the option of retreating to the solace of my compound and live an unmolested life, then yeah, I'm willing to put up with the inconveniences of being part of this group of people, whatever it is, collection of people.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with that. Because then I'm at least, you know,
So then it's a matter of scale, then. I mean, you're saying we're paying for things we don't want now. You're going to anyway. So it's just a matter of scale, right? Now, I agree with you. You would have the choice in that case.
Right.
But like you said, most people are going to agree to be part of this.
No one is going to show up at my door with guns and say, you must buy this new iPhone. Right?
Right.
At least not yet. I mean, Apple doesn't have the, you know.
Google maybe. But.
Yeah, maybe Google. Google's got, you know, droids that are doing
barges,
it now.
And yeah.
Cyborgs.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's the difference.
Well, you're aggrieved because you don't have that solace. You can't go into the compound. Funny you use the word compound. It's starting to make me worry a little bit.
As if it exists already.
Yeah, I'm trying to play into the stereotype.
Right, you mentioned guns and compounds, so this is probably being recorded by the NSA.
Right.
Oh, they've been listening for months.
They love it. I hear they're big.
Yeah, that's right.
Right. Yeah, you're nowhere close to having that solace, right? Because they're coming with guns every April 15th.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
And somehow you didn't really know you signed up for that, but you somehow were born in this geographical region.
Right. So I wrote an essay, I don't know, a couple of years back about the Supreme Court case, Hale versus Henkel, and I know I've brought this up on the show before, but it's sort of a fossil fossil record of what freedom used to be like in this country. You know, it's a little nugget of evidence that shows what freedom was when the Supreme Court case was decided in 1906. You know, so 100 years ago.
Tell us about it, freedom
was very different.
In what way? Stop teasing the...
Well, I mean, the decision, you know, the majority decision out of this case was that that the American citizen has the right to live his life unmolested by anybody. He owes nothing to the government, to his fellow citizens. He is free to...
What about healthcare?
He's free to travel. He's free to contract with whoever he wants, do whatever he wants, and... You know, the government has no right to impose its restrictions on that.
That's so 1906.
Is that really? I mean, when did that ever exist in this country? What are we saying that was it?
Well, I mean, you know, we've talked about this past episodes.
Are we talking about federal government? Are we talking about state government? Are we talking about what government?
All of them. I mean, when I say government, I'm usually referring to all of them, but...
I don't know that that was... I mean, I think even when the Constitution was laid out, I mean, the states were the ones that have the power. I don't think any of the framers would have said no government. I mean, that was the whole point.
I mean, because actually, obviously, when they went from the Articles of Confederation to the Constitution, you got a stronger government, not a weaker one. Right?
Right, and I mean, the anti-federalists were very much opposed to that. They said the Constitution gave the federal government way too much power.
And that's...
And then they pointed at the Whiskey Rebellion as evidence of that fact. You know, we were, 4 years into the new Constitution and you know, Washington deploys troops to shoot at civilians. We're off the rails already, people. This is supposed to be the land of the free. What happened? But, okay, so the Whiskey Rebellion's one watershed event. You could point to, you know, Lincoln, the Civil War, suspension of habeas corpus, all of that as another possible milestone.
Repeal of Jim Crow laws, because obviously that kept people from segregating, you know, according to their choice, right? I mean, let's be honest. I mean, obviously I'm being kind of facetious, but let's be honest, because part of that freedom is that sort of freedom. I mean, there's an ugly side to that freedom as well, right?
Yeah, sure.
People that didn't have freedom.
Well, but I mean... I can't, this establishment we're sitting in cannot tell an African-American that walks through the door that, I'm sorry, we're not going to serve you tonight. That's against the law.
Okay.
Right? And obviously, in your model, they would have the freedom to do that.
Yes.
So, I mean...
And I'm not saying that's right by any means, but that's what freedom is. Freedom is... You know, the ability to be stupid, to make mistakes, to make poor decisions.
To be ugly.
Yeah. And, I mean, that's just human nature, right?
I guess, and I think, you know, to bring it to sort of a, just sort of maybe a liberal democratic stance, like one thing that I kind of rage against, I guess, on kind of the Republican mindset, or maybe conservative mindset, is this nostalgia. That shows up like this these good old days when you could just tell somebody that they couldn't have a beer here. You know, it's like, well, that was when we had our freedoms. Like, I don't really get the I don't get the heartwarming past part of it. You know.
Yeah. Well, I don't agree with that either. I mean, I, you know.
But I do. It's like that's why I respect kind of your overall views. Is that you're willing to things start for you with the views, and you're willing to take the goods and the bads that come out of that, that follow from that sort of freedom, right?
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to be logically consistent, you have to.
Right, and that's what makes you unique, because you don't really get that kind of logical consistency from the freedom crowd or the states' rights crowd,
right,
or the constitutional
crowd. I think that's across the board, quite honestly. I think everybody has a nostalgia about something. They're willing to put their rose-colored glasses on when they look into the past and see how much worse it is now, you know.
Yeah.
And willing to overlook the whole slavery thing and women's suffrage,
right.
You know. We're discounting that. So I don't think that's a uniquely concern. I mean,
I guess
there is a social, I mean, you know, maybe the idea of conservatism, just based on the word, is you're conserving something
right,
from the past,
versus
right?
Progressivism. Right. You think, hey, we're making progress.
Yeah, but I do think that's fairly universal.
It's a matter of degree. There is, definitely some isolated nostalgia going on.
All right. So,
thoroughly sidetracked, and I don't know what.
It was good. It was good. Another story that I wanted to make sure we talk about. Where is it? Sorry, I'm...
Fascinating podcast.
Dead air. Just listen to the music.
Talk amongst yourselves, listeners.
Yeah, talk amongst yourselves.
This is what these hours of preparation before the podcast is.
Yes.
Just read the reading room.
Oh, here it is. Oh. So this kind of dovetails with what we were talking about a minute ago. The headline is Confederate flag was the flag of traitors. This was another op-ed piece on CNN that I had engaged with the author on Twitter. He did not respond, but basically saying that he doesn't like the Confederate flag, not because of the racist connotations that are associated with it, but because all of the people in the South were traitors, because they murdered the North, like the Northern soldiers that fought against them,
and
because they seceded,
You know what astounds me most about this? It's that you actually look at CNN.
and then click onto the op-ed. To find it against
Actually, I will say this. I had a military history class in college, and when we got to the Civil War, the teacher made the point that you can make the argument that the soldiers in the Confederate Army who had been, federal soldiers were traitors, because when they enlisted with the Army, that they had, sworn to uphold the Constitution, et cetera, and they broke that. So if he was narrowing it down to, the soldiers, he might have a point. But
yeah. So my comment to him, and this was Dean Obadala, my comment to him on Twitter was that, hey, look, the founding fathers, created their own country, raised an army, and went to war with Britain. Yeah. We're a nation of traitors.
Yeah, and I know we've talked about this before, that actually it's pretty easy to read the Constitution believing that they thought that situation could arise again.
Right.
And that's an acceptable part of what humanity should go through. So therefore, the Civil War was, or the South seceding was legitimate from that standpoint.
Right.
Yeah, we've talked about that before.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm certainly, it's the war of Northern aggression as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, boy. I do. I like to think about like my third grade self. That's about as far as I've gotten in my Civil War understanding. But otherwise. But it's just in a funny, simplistic sense. I just always thought it was weird. Like, she got the North, and you're all kind of Northy. It's like kind of like a boyfriend girlfriend.
All kind of Northy.
Northy.
Okay, that's
the
new quote of the night.
And then the South as your girlfriend in
it's
high
kind
school.
Kind of Southy.
She's Southy, and she wants to leave. And you're like, no, you don't think
Rob,
I'm great.
Come
you know
on.
What I'm gonna do?
That's right. I'm gonna smack you down
and like completely destroy you, and then you'll learn how great I am.
Right. I don't know what Constitution Lincoln was reading when he thought he had the power to preserve the Union. This Union of States that all voluntarily asked for membership.
Right.
And so, nowhere in the Constitution does it say you can't leave.
Right. You don't have to convince me of that one. I mean, I winners write the history books, right?
Right.
Few of us disagree that many of the end results of the Civil War were a good thing. But yeah, like I say, it's a politically incorrect constitutional question to ask these days. But you're not going to get a lot of argument out of me on that one.
But I think in the third grade sense, there must have felt like, hey, we had an agreement,
right?
Like my northern industrial complex, to misuse a term, help build your stuff, right?
Right.
So you can't just take it and leave now because we're in this,
Right.
Like it was a betrayal of something, like a contract that's already been written.
Right.
got to refresh my constitution here, but doesn't it talk something about... I just can't access it right now. But is it like traitor? I mean, isn't there something in the constitution?
Sedition and...
Yeah. You know, essentially making war against your own government.
Yes.
So when the South seceded, are they not making war against
government? Who fired the first shot? I mean, they were...
I don't know that it has to be a shot.
Well, it does, because, I mean, who initiated force? Because they're the immoral actor. Because all the South did was say, hey, look, we don't want to play by your rules anymore. We've gone off and formed our own country now. You can either recognize us or not, but we're done with you.
That gets a beat down.
And so then the federal government said, whoa, Fort Sumter, that belongs to us. So we're coming in, we're going to take it, we're letting you know. And they said, no, it's in South Carolina, that's now part of the Confederate States of America, sorry, your rules don't apply anymore. And, you know, then you're in a standoff, so...
Yeah, I just don't have the mental power for it right now.
Don't have your pocket constitution on you.
Too many beers.
I feel like there's, you know, I don't think it has to be a shot fired necessarily to be an act of being a traitor or, you know, going against your government. You know, the fact that you are seceding and this sort of contract.
I mean, if they
just decided they were going to exit, I don't know if they could even do that.
So,
I mean, that's not really... So I'm not saying that a shot. I'm not saying that it wasn't.
Were the people who refused to return fugitive slaves, were they traitors? Because they were going against the government too.
I don't know if they were traitors.
Well, I'm just.
They might be lawbreakers.
My point.
Lawbreakers, but I think when you're talking about seceding from the federal government, that's a very large action.
It's the polite action, right? It's like, hey, you know what? Thanks for inviting me to your party, but I'm not really having a good time, so I'm going to leave. As opposed to, you suck, I'm going to kill you.
But it's a little different, like, we've already signed this agreement that we're going to be in this party.
Right, now to get
out of that, we have to take some other action, we can't just, like, take our ball and go home.
Yeah, it's like a gang, you got to get beat in, then you got to get beat up.
You get beat in, but, like, you make an agreement when you go in, right. So you have to find a way to get out that is part of that agreement. And if you go outside of that,
the Constitution provides for joining the Union. There are no provisions in there for leaving.
So bad for the South for joining without recognizing that.
Wow.
If they signed a contract to join with no exit clause, that's their fault, right?
Right.
For a contract and you don't have an exit clause,
Article 3, treason.
Treason
against the United States shall consist only in levying war against them or in adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort. No person shall be convicted of treason unless on the testimony of two witnesses to the same overt act or on confession in open court. So they're obviously talking about specific individuals there, states.
Right, I think Chris's point, if I could make it poorly, more poorly than he made it, was that there is a concept of treason in the Constitution. There is a concept of you can be against this government and we will come beat you down for it.
And there's a lot of invalid concepts in the Constitution.
Well, I don't know if they're invalid or not, but that's what they signed up for.
Okay.
They have agreed to that contract. So if they went out of that contract, they have to go through the proper change to do that, which would be amending the Constitution.
Right.
It's a little bit like, not just we're going to take our ball and go home.
Well, by that argument, you know, we should have continued to redress King George for our grievances instead of, you know, starting a revolution. I'm just saying
that... I'm totally not disagreeing that. I'm just saying that the North's action may have been well within the Constitution. Right. I don't think it goes against the Constitution.
I think the North's action was determined by Lincoln's pride and nothing else. I don't think he wanted to be the president. He didn't want his legacy to be he was the president that allowed the Union to dissolve. So he was going to do that by all means necessary.
He fought with the Union.
And as far as the the tie between these states, I think like think if Texas wants to secede, they always like to bandy that about Rick, good old Rick Perry wants to take it. You know, and say he wants to, and so and like Texas, like we're our own country. Well, that's great. You know, you got your Houston, Dallas, and your funny baseball teams that aren't any good, and you think you're all awesome. Well, that's fine, but you're only awesome because you got the entire nation's security around you. You have the entire nation's economics around you. You have interstate. You have a lot of stuff that's built around you that has made you that awesome. You didn't just awesome it yourself.
So I'm not making this up. Weren't there like 11 counties in Colorado that voted to secede in this election?
Yes.
I mean, that just happened last week.
Whenever. Oh, really?
To secede from Colorado. Not from the United States, well, but they want to form their own state.
And I think Colorado said
and the 51st state.
It's a cluster of rural counties on the Kansas border, and yeah, they all voted to secede from Colorado.
Get rid of their Boulder, Colorados.
Yeah, I mean, it's not unprecedented. There was a vote in Northern California to do the same thing a couple of years back.
So how'd it go?
They're still talking about it, I think.
Yeah. Well, according to the Constitution, those counties have to get permission from Colorado to secede, and then permission from the United States Congress to form their own state.
Sounds good. Let's do it.
I don't have a problem with it.
So, my only point in that is that this idea of secession is not completely dead, right?
Right.
But it is weird to... Seceding to create your own state would be different than seceding from the whole nation that is supported. And I think that's why I in my core I don't have any history background, but I don't feel like he's just linking with a big old, you know,
F you.
Yeah, right. I think he's like, hey, look, we're in this together, you know, we've gotten this far.
I think he wrapped his true feelings in a bunch of platitudes, and that's what you're taught in grade school.
You think Lincoln was like a vampire hunter?
I think Lincoln was a tyrant. There, I said it.
I've heard this before. I don't necessarily agree with that.
I've only
the
heard
vampire hunter or the tyrant part?
Both.
I've only heard it south of this area. I've never heard it actually in this area.
So, you've heard the saying that you can tell the difference between a liberal and a conservative by their opinion on FDR. Well, you can tell the difference between a conservative and a libertarian by their opinion of Lincoln.
Right.
Yeah.
It's a good statement.
Actually, I've heard that before from another anarchist. I think it's a... from my small samples.
Your small samples.
It's a recurring theme, so...
Yes.
Yeah.
Good episode, team.
All right.
I got animated.
I think I think that was a good discussion. We're probably out of time and out of stuff to talk about, so I want to thank GC Food and Brewery for hosting us. Want to thank our listeners, of course, and got to thank Chris, our guest, and thank Eric, our guest host.
Way to go, Eric.
And we will welcome Jeremy back with open arms next episode. That will be our year in review. We'll talk about all the best stories of 2013, so be sure to tune in for that. And we'll see you next time.
Bye now.
Good night.
Oh, good night. I'm used to being the guest, not the host. I don't have that whole...